So Stuart and I had the delightful occasion to have a conversation with our guest tonight, Laura Morgan, on the radio show a few weeks ago. And we were talking about her wonderful book, Three Jewels, A Field Guide to Three West Sonoma County Trail Systems. And it was an occasion, of course, for me to look at the book and get to read the book before our conversation. And I can say it is a real asset for those of us who have been on some of these trails but didn't have any knowledge, and it makes me want to go back to those trails with the book in hand and look at the geology, look at some of the notes on flora and fauna as well. But of course, the real reason that we want to have her on this in this Thursdays at Many Rivers program is because she's also very articulate about her spiritual engagement with the landscape of Sonoma County. And so please join me in welcoming Laura Morgan, MD, to Many Rivers Books and Tea.
Thank you all for coming. Thank you for hosting, you and Stuart and Jim. And I'm just really surprised that this many people came out, because it seems a little obscure to me, even to myself, what I've done here. But that really is a good description of why the book is being sold and promoted here. I really do have a sense of spiritual connection to the landscape. And especially in these times when there are so many things changing legislatively, potentially, for our coast, it's just making me think more and more about why it is that this landscape is so important to me, and probably for all of you as well. So I like to introduce ourselves to each other, and if that feels all right to you, what I'd like to do is have each person just say their first name and maybe name a place in Sonoma County that's dear to you. So would you mind beginning?
No, I'm Monique, and I live on Burbank Heights. So I really like it there. I don't have a car, so I walk, and it's good to be among the trees.
Oui. And Chance, you?
Chance? I like the waterfall at, what's it called?
Bouverie?
No, that's
Bohemian.
Sugarloaf. The waterfall at Sugarloaf. It's a favorite place.
I'll have to go there. Yeah, okay, thank you. And
My name is Patrick, and there are many places, but one of them where I lead bird walks is on Pine Flat in my office.
So you get there by going through Healdsburg?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, I'm so provincial. I haven't been east of Santa Rosa for a long time. At Shepherd?
Yeah. My farm. I named it after Coco Pelli. Wounded healer.
Kathleen?
I'm Kathleen, and there's lots of places too. I have a favorite prayer meditation spot at Bodega Head, and then recently I've really connected with Jenner Headlands, and then I love the spot where I live near Water Trough and Sanders too.
Jennifer's my name, and what's special to me is the part of Pullman Canyon Trail that's in the Redwoods.
My name is Anne. I also was the Bodega Head. Lived out there for a long time, and that has a real special place for me. And Red Hill. But so many. I mean, we just went to Jack London today. And hiked in the Redwoods there, and there's hard to find a place like this.
Yes.
My name is Jim, and one of the places is there on the Quirtum Trail, the rocks that were rubbed by the more recently, just this day when we visited Jack London and came upon that 2,000-year-old redwood.
Oh my God.
Which is it's a marvel. It's a very special tree.
With its
Oh, wow.
All the way, and yeah, it's growing on the burls.
Oh, wow.
Amazing.
I'll carpool. I'll get out there somehow.
Well worth it.
Okay, yeah. Thank you for that. Yeah, hi.
Hi, I'm Eric, and a lot of these places inspire me, but I would say Como Canyon is one that stuck out in my mind, plus the Cordon Trail.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
I'm Cheryl.
Yes, yes, I agree. Armstrong Red Wizards feels really holy, doesn't it? Yeah. Thanks. And Jim.
Yes, Jim, and it's Armstrong Red.
My name's Odin. I think my favorite spot in Sonoma County, in fact, I know my favorite spot in Sonoma County is up at Sonoma Lakes. The Santa Rosa Junior College has astronomy department has a campground up there dedicated to astronomy that we get to work at, and there's no light pollution, and there's no people, and you're there with a telescope.
That's
and you get
really
to just
special.
Look at the stars. It's one of the most amazing and magical places I think I've ever experienced. Just for that.
Great.
Where is it?
It's up at Sonoma Lake, but it's tucked way, way in the back. You have to take one of the side roads down a couple of miles to get to where the campground is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it has a name?
It's just like a spot.
I think they're calling it, you know,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'll give you a little bit of background about me and the book. I wrote this book as a way to heal myself after having been a family practice doctor for 30 years in a very rapid-fire system, which was Kaiser in Oakland, and before that, Kaiser in Fairfield. And I had wanted to do this for a long time because all through, since I moved to Sonoma County in 1970 and started school at Sonoma State, I had been running and hiking in the places that I wrote about, and so I had this very long history of it. How do I put this? It's associated with me, for me, with a sense of freedom, with a sense of being in alignment with nature, a sense of getting beyond the pressure of discursive thought, which is always a big distraction for somebody who does what I do, or actually anybody who lives in the modern world. There are so many things happening so fast, especially with electronic media. So to get back to myself, especially at times of trouble, I would go to nature as a refuge, even since an early childhood. So when I moved up here, I was just blown away by the beauty of West Sonoma County. I first saw it at age 16, and I fell in love with it at that point, and it was sort of a goal of mine to move back here. And then when I retired from Kaiser a few years ago, I decided this would be the time, you know, before I get stuck with anything else. I have a lot of things I'm stuck with, but I thought before anything else comes, let me just, take this opportunity and do something that feels really healing for myself. So. Michelle Luna at Stewards of the Coast and Redwoods encouraged me to write about Austin Creek backcountry because there's nothing written about that, probably because it's very difficult to access. You really have to think safety before you go in there, especially during summer. But to me, it's the most pristine of all in the sense of being what they call protected topography, which means that you go down and up and down again to get into the heart of Austin Creek. And then from there, you can go up or down creek to find really amazing things. So when she said that to me, I wanted to benefit Stewards with the book. They now own it. And my goal tonight is for you to have fun and maybe learn something, and also to try to sell some books for Stewards of the Coast and Redwoods. You can get a great deal if you buy directly from them instead of Amazon. Or, and you can also get a good deal on shipping costs if you just go pick it up. So they're at the visitor center in Jenner and also at Armstrong Redwoods Visitor Center, and they get all the proceeds. So it's a wonderful thing. So that's that. And then Chance and I were talking just a little bit before I started this to speak myself, and he said to me, he's interested to hear my perspective about why this is particularly sacred. And I think that the question is a great one, because I think we all, you know, just going around the room just now, we all have a place that we bonded to, that we have a history of association with, coming back to our core selves in some way that replenishes us, restores our energy, puts things in perspective. Even things like death, huge losses, fears, guilt. If you go to nature, particularly a place that you have a long history of association with, at times of trouble, it can heal you. It actually almost speaks to you. I'm sure you all have had some inkling of that. And along those lines, I brought something interesting for you to do. Unless anybody has a question at this moment or wants to specifically request that we deal with a certain part of the book before we go any further. Are there any questions about the book content, or does anybody want to register a preference for what I talk about right now? Gotcha all. Okay, well, here's what I did. This is kind of crazy, but that's me. I just picked up stuff on my land, and I brought it. And there's a lot of odd things. I only brought 9. I didn't think there'd be so many people. So what I'd like to do is just, I'm going to walk around to the last person first, pick something out of the bowl, and take a good look at it, feel it, touch it, smell it, taste it if you want to. Eat it. There are a couple of edibles in there.
Go ahead.
Okay, you want to share with somebody? Or?
Well, she said there were only 9.
There's only 9, but you know, you can share an object. That's the amazing thing. And both come up with different observations about it, or different experiences of it.
That'll work.
Oh, wait a minute. Yep, you got that. Hold, wait a minute. There's one more.
Okay. Okay,
great. Sure. We might end up with
let's
too
close
many.
Our eyes.
Kind of hard to miss that.
Oh, here.
You got it. Okay, great. Just so you can see all the options. That's pretty cool. Great. You want to play?
Sure. Okay. If you've got extra.
Yeah. Well, at this point, everybody's buddied up almost. So there's a lot of.
Well, buddies. The buddies is a good thing.
Yeah. Great. So what I'd like you to do is apply your senses to the object. First of all, notice what drew you to it. There must be some draw that you had to the object that you picked. And then really explore it sensorily and see what it teaches you or tells you. It doesn't have to be serious. It could be totally whimsical. Spurious, speculative, it doesn't matter. Just if there's a message coming from the thing you're looking at or sensorily exploring, see if you can receive that. think that just as we each had an affinity for what we picked, and each of us has a different take, maybe, on what it is that we're holding, the same phenomenon takes place when we're out in nature. There are certain things that we have an affinity to. It could be water, it could be rocks, it could be a skyline, you know, it could be a sound that we repeatedly hear, but a smell that we catch, but something that particularly appeals to us and takes us beyond pressured thinking. And in order to be in the state of receptivity, you have to almost deliberately nowadays make a decision that you're going to stop for a moment and just be present. And it's very difficult to do. There are some things that reach out and grab you and sort of throttle you into submission, attention-wise, because they're so outstanding and grand, and you just have to surrender to it, like the tree. But each one of these little tiny objects that are, you know, theoretically inanimate, they each have evolved to look, feel, taste, smell the way they do for a reason, just as we have as individuals and as a species. So when I say that I feel that the landscapes that I chose to write about are sacred, that was a personal preference. It's not something that I expect everybody to feel, but I think that it is just sort of objectively grand out at the coast and on Pomo Canyon and Red Hill and down in Austin Creek. And those things are so precious, and they're not making them anymore. And to be able to spend time in those environments is a tremendous privilege. I think we have one of the most beautiful landscapes in the world here. And I feel that my spirituality is tapped, and that my creativity and my sense of joyfulness and love and so forth are drawn out in those environments. So I can talk to you about geology. It's quite remarkable. The reason that it looks the way it does is because we're in one of the most tectonically active places in the world. And the way I wrote the book, I had been on a number of ecotourism jaunts in other countries, and every time we would be lectured by someone, they would be specialized in some area like botany or entomology, and they didn't really know the rest of it. They wouldn't know the geology of it, or the meteorology of it, or how the soil was formed, or what the history of the area was. And I always found myself wanting somebody who would sit down and tell me about the place and the animals in it, starting with the ground. And so that's what I told Michelle I'd like to do. And so I ended up getting a lot of help from geologists, because they knew that it was going to be a donation to Stewards of the Coast and Redwoods. They would just volunteer their time, were really generous, really collaborative, wonderful people that I got to meet in the process of writing the book. So I started with myself reading some cosmology, some meteorology, a lot of geology, which is a different language altogether and requires a lot of focus to understand, because it's three-dimensional and it's moving all the time so slowly that we can't perceive it, but in such a way that it's created such a huge environment around us that, you know, we can hardly absorb it. We're sort of partway between microbes and the universe in size, and our perceptual band is narrow compared to who knows what other dimensions or other perceptions other creatures on this planet have. But because of that, we can't really grasp geology very easily. So it took me a long time to sort of get the basics. And the way the book is laid out, it starts out with the coast, which is where the rubber hits the road. It's where the North American plate hits the Pacific plate, and it has a history of having been a different plate, a different oceanic plate, about 185 million years ago that was subsumed underneath the North American plate. That old plate was called the Farallon plate, and there's still a tiny bit of it protruding out around Cape Mendocino, but for the most part it's now tucked under the Sierras. And that's one of the reasons why we have the Sierras, is just that mountain building of effect of land pushing up from underneath. So now the Cordham Trail, for example, named after Dr. Bill Cordham. Do you all know who he was? Bill Cordham is probably the most important person in Sonoma County for the last, in terms of environmental protections, maybe that I can even think of ever. He was a veterinarian in Petaluma, and he grew up in the country, and his father told him when he was little that before he was old, he would see all of the open space built up, developed, housing put in, and so forth. And he was really sad because it all came to pass, as his father said. So he grew up watching all of the development take place. And he wasn't really an activist until it was noted by a woman who used to run her cattle down at Bodega Head that PG&E was on the land digging a big hole. And she tried to wave him off with a shotgun. Gaffney. Yeah. And she discovered that PG&E had struck a bargain with the Board of Supervisors to put in a nuclear power plant at Bodega Head, which which is posthumously known as the Hole in the Head. And it's now a beautiful pond. Yes, it is. And Bill Cordham was one of the activists involved in that. And he and a woman who was a housewife with three kids at the time, Doris Sloan, who is now a University of California, Berkeley, Professor Emeritus of Geology, who went back and got her geology degree because of her activism experience. The two of them, along with a number of other people, took to the streets this information that there was going to be potentially strontium-90 floating through the air, and they sent out helium balloons with a message on it that anybody who found it could have been a nuclear molecule. So it mobilized public opposition, and there was a geologist who heard about this conflict when he was driving across the Mojave Desert. It was played out on a LA sister station of KPFA, what was going on up here, and he called up, I can't remember if it was who he called. He called one of the members of this group and said, "How can I help?" And they said, "Well, come up here and take a look at what's happening." So he and Doris Sloan went into the construction site. There was no one there. It was on a Sunday. And the geologist climbed down and took a look at the excavation and saw this offsetting in the pattern of rock that was forming the wall of the hole. And he said, "You know what this is? It's the San Andreas Fault right here." And his declaration went viral, they would have called it then, or we call it now. And it was taken up by the Secretary of the Interior, Stuart Udall, and construction was halted until an environmental impact report was done. And PG&E ended up abandoning the site. So isn't that great?
It's a wonderful story.
It is, because a small group of citizens was able to stop this thing that was a done deal that was already written up in the PG&E offices on Market Street in San Francisco. Had direct transcript of the Board of Supervisors giving their approval before it was known by the public. This is important to remember. The Cordham Trail was named after him, and all he had to say about that was, "Gee, isn't it great to get something named after you before you die?" He was a really self-deprecating guy. He really, you know, it took a lot to get him to talk. And he and his wife, Lucy, they contributed to the book in the sense of telling me I had to write about Red Hill, because that's her daughter-in-law's favorite trail. And Bill had a special affection for that trail. He would spend a lot of time. There's a Wright's Beach. I don't know if you know about it. It's the south end of the trail, and there are small seeps from the hillside there. And he was entranced by the wildflowers that would grow in these seeps right up against these sheer, you'd call them, Oh, gee, it's hard to say what they are. They're mostly gray wacky, which means sedimentary particulate rock, you know, like sand or mud being compressed under pressure and temperature beneath the North American plate until they actually form solid rock. And that's what
you call it?
Gray wacky. Isn't that a wild name?
Wow.
I thought it was gray wack.
It
ends with an E. It's G-R-A-Y-W-A-C-K-E. And I thought it was gray wack, but a geologist said, well, ma'am, I'm sorry, it's wacky. and that comprises 80% of what you see in Sonoma County and along the coast is this compressed heated sandstone or, you know, particulate debris that was compressed down in the subduction zone and then came back up with earthquakes. So that's the principle that underlies everything you see around you in Sonoma County, except when you get out east, there's the Sonoma volcanics, which are everything Annadel north along Sonoma Mountain, Annadel, Sugarloaf. They're all former volcanoes. There's obsidian there. You know, Native American people carved arrow points out of the obsidian from those mountains. And everything west of that is former lake bed called Wilson Grove, which is a form of soil that's very porous, alluvial soil where water used to stand for millions of years and then percolated down. And then as you get closer to the coast, you start to see more metamorphic rock. For example, Casadero is famous for its blue schist, which refers to a particular chemical composition of rock that is known as glaucophane schist. And it's blue, it's shiny, and that's what the mammoths rubbed on. If you buy that theory, that whole rock that has separated into three big pieces that Jim was mentioning, that's blue schist, and it's a highly metamorphic rock, which means that when it was first born out of a trench out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean as lava, and then carried, as that plate moved eastward, carried up to finally subduct underneath the North American plate, that rock went down fast and at high temperature, and it became altered chemically to form something that's completely different from its previous incarnation as magma, as mantle rock, which is mainly iron, manganese, nickel. So that rock is really special, and if you catch it at a certain phase in its development, it actually has tiny garnets that are scattered all through it like pepper. Very beautiful. There's an example of that in the Serpentine area that's maintained by UC Davis up along Harrison Grade Road. Mm. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but there's an area that looks parched and stunted because it's growing on old mantle rock, which is serpentine, and it's associated rocks. And I'd have to show you. It says no trespassing, but I went on a hike there with a land trust with a geologist who showed it to us. So there's that level of metamorphism where, you know, you get these outrageous, beautiful rocks. And then I should also mention, so there's the sedimentary rocks, which is your sandstone that's been compressed so much that it now looks like a very hard gray rock, now called gray wacky. There's the metamorphic rocks like blue schist. Then there's the igneous rocks, which are the ones that have retained their original volcanic nature, like obsidian and basalt. So the book looks at the geology of the coastal zone, and then it moves into the coast ranges a little bit by following Pomo Canyon, which takes off at Shell Beach, one of the most geologically famous sites in the world, because you can see metamorphic rocks calving out of Earth's mantle, which is the serpentine hillside there. And it takes you all the way up to the top of the hill on that trail up Pomo Canyon, where you can see amazing bird life. big raptors, like golden eagles. If you keep your eyes open, you'll see these gigantic, they look like flying planks from below. A lot of marsh hawks, red-shouldered hawks, red-tailed hawks. And then down the other side of it, you go along the plateau, and there are all these seeps where water has come through the hillside in little, they appear to be springs, and they're most of the time flowing really heavily. You can see incredible animal tracks up there because those springs are water for many different animals, including mountain lions. And the tracks are very evident. And then you go down into Redwood Grove, which is a whole different ecological zone. So it takes you through about six different ecozones on the way into the Redwood Grove. And there's a reason why we each resonate with a certain place. And on an intellectual level, I didn't know what I was looking at. Now that I have a better idea, it makes my affection for the land deeper because I can appreciate it with more of my faculties than I did before. But to me, the ultimate is Austin Creek, and the reason for that is because its headwaters arise in the Cedars, which is an area, if, I don't know if any of you have been there, you've been there, Chase?
No.
The Cedars is a remarkable place where the Earth's mantle has punched up through a defect in the crust, and instead of being 3 to 70 miles below the crust surface, which is normally where it is, it's a couple thousand feet above the Earth's, the crust surface. And it is comprised entirely of serpentinite or serpentine, which is this ultra heavy metal soil that nothing can grow in except very specific types of plants. And it, those very specific types of plants are hosts for very specific, weird, wacky insects, like the black petal-tailed dragonfly. Which is, it's a very ancient dragonfly that's only found in certain kinds of ponds that are year-round or creeks that are very slow-flowing so that the larva can dig a burrow. And like an antlion, it waits in the burrow for some aquatic creature to float by, and then it leaps out and grabs the prey and digests it down in the burrow. And it stays in a larval form for, I think, I'm trying to remember my own book, it's something like 5 years. It's very long-lived larva. And then when it finally metamorphoses into the dragonfly, that creature has only a few weeks of life. And the petal tail is so called because dragonflies mate with the male's, the tip of the male's tail on the female's head to hold her in position, and they hook up in the form of a heart. It's very sweet. And we have one of the world's experts on dragonflies in this county, Kathy Biggs, who lives in Sebastopol and has a demonstration dragonfly pond in her backyard. She's a really cool lady. And the head of that dragonfly is so big that the male's tail has formed this petal. It's like it has to have two different places to fit around the female's eyes, which are so wide set. And dragonflies migrate just like birds. There are some dragonflies that migrate across the Great Lakes. So I don't know if the petal tail does or not, but it's such an ancient creature. It hasn't changed for millennia, and it's similar to redwoods in the sense that it has not genetically varied for millions of years. And I have yet to see one. I've seen pictures, but I haven't actually seen one of them because you'd have to go way up Austin Creek to its origin in the Cedars, which is now Bureau of Land Management property. It was donated to them by Roger Raich, who's a botanist who used to direct the UC Berkeley Tilden native plant section of their botanical gardens. And Roger recognized that this is a weird place and there's some really weird things that I've never seen before. So he has a couple of plants named after him. And then he donated that land to all of us through the Bureau of Land Management, which is maintaining it, protecting it for us all to see at some point, hopefully. see, where did I, how many minutes do I have? Does anybody have any questions at this point? Or yes, Kathleen.
Well, I just have a comment, and
sure.
It was interesting because I think, you know, what I'm hearing is about your deep relationship to the land,
and
I'm really looking at that more closely because that's relationship is what creates that desire to care for the environment,
yes.
Right? The thing that I have learned, having lived in some native communities, is like holding this rock. You know, I said to Jennifer, I said, well, it's really alive. And so I believe, theoretically, they're animate. You know, and you had talked about inanimate, and I think that that's a different, there's just differences in view, but like the people of this land originally, you know, would
yes.
see that as animate, and I think that that's probably what you're really feeling, except that from our, you know, the other point of view, things are always considered inanimate from the European view. So
right.
I was observing that.
That's a wonderful observation. Yeah. So have you spent time with people who lived here on the coast, like Pomo Miwok people?
A few people.
Uh-huh.
From this area.
Uh-huh.
More from down south and
yeah.
in the southwest.
Uh-huh. Thank you for that.
Another resource that you may have come across, I don't know if you have yet, but the book Saving the Marin and Sonoma Coast by Marty Griffin, who would be a very close second, if not, to Bill Cordham
uh-huh.
In terms of his impact on both the Sonoma and Marin Coast, because without him and a handful of people in Marin, we would now have 150,000 people living between Olema and Tamales.
Wow.
That
amazing.
Was the plan. Right?
Wow.
They managed to stop that. Going to the lagoon would be dredged, there'd be a yacht harbor there, and 50,000 people living there. Tennessee Valley would be basically a big housing development. So, you know, and he's been very active in Sonoma County, but that book is one of the most inspiring environmental books I've ever read, because it's a story of success.
Thank you.
That's how that came about.
Thank you so much.
Bill Cordham is mentioned in the book, and Marty and Bill are friends. And they were both figured prominently in the book Rebels with a Cause, a film that was recently debuted.
I got to see that.
So those would be two things that if you're interested in our coastal habitat, then to definitely
thank you.
The name of the book is Saving the Marin and Sonoma Coast by Marty Griffin, who is the founder of Audubon Canyon Ranch.
Thank you very much. And then somebody else had their hand up.
I want to follow up on another resource.
Sure.
It appears in the film called The Russian River, All Rivers.
Yes.
He's featured in it.
Oh.
And he used to have one of the most prominent vineyards around wineries called the Hop Kiln.
Oh, yes.
And it was very environmental. We used to always meet there for the big environmental gatherings. And it was an example of how to have a diversified farm.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just wine and chickens and... He and his wife, who's an artist, and they finally retired him. He's also a physician, as a matter of fact. They retired and went back to Berlin, where they were originally from.
Yeah, one of the most remarkable things I read recently, actually know Marty fairly well, and he showed me his valedictory speech in 1938.
Wow.
He keeps everything. He has all of his mementos from his amazing life, and it's a typed page, and in that he encapsulated what his entire life was going to be. He was a doctor who realized that treating patients individually in an office is a very small part of health. That what the environment we live in is the medicine.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you're basically talking
yes.
about. And it's all there. It is in the age of 18, he mapped out his entire life. I mean, I've never seen anybody who did that.
18.
At the age of 18, his valedictory speech from the high school.
Wow.
He talks about, you know, we Americans are moving at far too great a pace.
Mm-hmm.
We're overwhelmed by all of the, just imagine how he would see it now, by all of the information and all that sort of thing. And so now So now I am setting out as an 18-year-old to remedy.
Wow, what an amazing thing. It's almost Gandhian, you know?
Yeah, it is.
Like to see your mission that early and to just pursue it.
Yeah.
Yeah, Kat, is there?
Well, what you're bringing up and what he's talking about, and there's a book I got, this one recently, Richard Blue, the Nature
Principle. I have that. It's great.
But, you know, it seems like there are multiple minds coming to this place of recognizing how important our connection to nature is for health. And I'm just curious if you used that at all when you were working as a physician, like giving people prescriptions to go out, or if it was more, because he's talking about that in this book, and that more people may be doing that when they're practicing medicine because of the research that shows, you know.
Uh-huh.
But did you do that when you were in practice, or is it something you did for yourself? And
it was more what I did for myself, because in practice I was very much in a reactive state with a lot of time pressure and high acuity, you know, patients. If I had someone who was open to the concept, you know, or who I, because I always got to know my patients personally. If there were, you know, unless I was doing urgent care, I got to know everybody, you know, what their lives were like. So the people that I did know had an affinity for the outdoors or a practice of, you know, some outdoor activity. I always talked to them about that, and we always had agreement about that being very important. But I've very rarely been able to prescribe that for someone who's not already in some way in touch with that in themselves. I know that Michelle Luna of Stewards in the Coast and Redwoods sees the next generation of school children as her window of opportunity for instilling environmental values, especially in the Spanish-speaking population, because they will be the stewards. In the Native Plant Society now has a chapter in Baja with Spanish-speaking stewards of Baja. So I think that there needs to be some kind of childhood experience. I think that really helps. And it worries me that that's becoming further and further, away from most kids now. It's scary to see that. Does anybody else have any thoughts about that, or experiences, or resources that they'd like to recommend, or questions?
Well, I think one of the things that's really important to realize is just how many different hiking opportunities and groups in Sonoma County. So, you know, I mean, we have those of us who are working in the Mayacamas. Some people say Mayacamas, others say Mayacamas. There's a Mayacamas meetup site where there are hikes at least two or three times a week in the Mayacamas. Led by botanists or led by birders like myself, or geologists, or Kathy Biggs does stuff there. So yeah, that's available, and there's more than I'm even aware of. I know that,
there's
people going out in all kinds of contexts. But there's the Madrone Audubon Society, which every week has several bird walks. It's an entryway. Just as you said, you. Whatever it is that you're particularly interested in draws you in, and then everything starts to...
Right, and socially as well. Then you start to find meaningful activities to do with other people. And Anne, you were going to say something?
I was noticing as a teacher, that was something that I always wanted to do with my children and did do, going out into nature and getting that connection. And what I noticed in the last position that I was in, that in the Roseland area schools and in the Kiwanis Springs area schools, they're having quite a few people who come in and work with the kids, taking them out for creek cleanups, doing a lot of work to instill that at the very beginning. So I think there is
wonderful
hope for that to be happening, and that is in the Hispanic community. That I was aware of it, but I think it's all over, and I know Jim is doing some volunteer work now that is through the
Through land paths.
Through land paths. So meeting with children, taking them out to different places.
That's fantastic.
Riverside. So it is becoming more a part, I think, of and valued through schools in education. If you get an administrator that's about testing, all about the land. So I think
that's encouraging to hear.
It is, and I think maybe that's the kind of thing that we can all do to encourage the children, because I really support that part. We have such a responsibility to let the kids get out and just walk a trail.
Yeah, that's why the test scores are getting lower, is because they're not out.
But then schools are also growing gardens, so there's garden to table. And so I think there is a lot out there.
Yeah, I just had two opportunities. Both of which I've taken are to become docents here at the Laguna Foundation or Bouverie Preserve or Ottawa Canyon Ranch, if you want to, because they have incredible programs to teach you about your local environment, and then you get to teach kids. So it's a win. You win both ways. So I encourage people to look into that.
There was a docent who was at the Jenner Visitor Center, but he works out in La Laguna too, and he said that there were kids from Roseland that had never been outside, and they were scared to sit on the ground.
Wow.
I felt for them, and I had done some volunteer work in outdoor ed program before it went defunct out of Napa, and we'd have kids come for a day. And we take them on trails and stuff. It was fascinating to see how they came alive once they could relax out there. So I think you're right. There is more, and the CYO camp has, programs going for kids.
It's that fear factor, that not knowing about something that I think is really... Now, the program that you're working with is great because they do it four times a year. I mean, it should be... But four times a year they come back and they see what it is that they have started. They clear the corn out of
their farm.
They clear the corn that has already grown. They taste whatever it is that's still there. So
that's fantastic. Continuity,
That was interesting. You were talking about deepening your relationship by learning more about the geology and all.
Yes.
What was that?
It has to do with bringing my intellect as well as just sort of this intuition to look at things. When I went into the sciences, it was because my spiritual teacher asked me to be a doctor, not because I wanted to be a doctor ever. I really was dreading the whole thing. And I remember...
Were you at
Woodbound?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I know, I've seen you.
Maybe
before.
I know you.
Yeah, I've seen you because I taught at Tamales High School.
Geez Louise. How funny. So I became a doctor for my teacher, and at the time I was not a numbers or science person at all. I was doing a master's in English Lit at Sonoma State. And so I had to go back and do the pre-med, the science, and I remember in physics class going, whoa, I'll never look at a drop of water the same. I'll never see something fall. I'll never sit down again the same way. It just, once you... see the patterns and the history and the way things unfold according to their own intrinsic natures and then in interrelationships with other things, it completely it makes the world a miracle to you. And I think that's where most of us would be, is in that sort of state of wonder a lot more, were we not so distracted and time pressured. But that's what doing this book did for me. It put me in touch with all those questions that my intuition led me to have that got satisfied to some extent intellectually as much as I could take in researching and in talking with the consultants. And so now when I look at rocks, for example, when I'm running, I'm looking at what's under my feet. I just have to or I'll fall down. but I'll see the strata of rocks under my feet. I'll see a basalt dike up in the Oakland Hills. That happened this morning. And I'll go, wow, that used to be down on the Pacific Plate in the middle of a trench extruding lava. And now it's up here. What does that tell you? You know, it just makes the world a wonder. So I think I should stop pretty soon.
We can go for another 10 or 15 minutes, but it's whatever you're comfortable with.
Well, I could just like gush on forever, but I don't want to bore people. I want you all to get what you need.
Read a passage.
Okay. Thank you. I'm at the age where I now forgot everything that I wrote about. Let's see. Oh, salmon. How amazing are they? Okay, so I'll read you. Okay, well, first I have to read you a little bit about newts. Are you familiar with newts? So this is down on Austin Creek. This cool riparian environment with slow-moving water and small pools is an ideal place for California newts to mate. These amazing amphibians spend most of the year in moist crevices between rocks and soil. With the warmer temperatures and slowing of creek flow during spring, they migrate back to the creek where they were born. Along the way, and all through the spring and early summer, the males do ferocious battle for territory and females. The males cram themselves between mating pairs. They grab the passive females and steer them around underwater with their large, powerful tails. And the big newts eat the little ones. It's just horrifying to observe this stuff. It's like Jurassic Park. Then they take rest, floating and still between bursts of activity. All this action creates a voracious appetite, and as you'll probably note, there are plenty of mosquitoes and mosquito larvae here, one of the newts' favorite foods. California newts eat a kind of bacteria that produces tetrodotoxin, a nerve toxin that causes paralysis. This is the same toxin that is used in Haiti to poison people, then psychologically manipulate them into roles of servitude, known as zombies. California newts carry the highest concentration of tetrodotoxin known in the world. Their defense against predators like garter snakes. Who would think that a garter snake would take that much toxin to immobilize it? So for that reason, we recommend that you not handle or eat them. There was one unfortunate guy who warmed up his coffee one morning that had been out overnight in a pot at his campsite, and there was a newt in the pot, and he died at the campsite. And there was an autopsy done, and they found that he he dosed on tetrodotoxin. They found the newt in the coffee pot.
Whoa!
That's a true story. I can't remember. It was probably more than a decade ago. But
wow.
So.
Check your
don't lick them either. Okay, and then the other thing, well, you probably are all aware about water, right? About how there's so little of it. In West County, there are four watersheds where residential users of well water are being asked to account for their water use. And it's a very daunting set of forms that we're all filling out, and we're all resentful because the wineries are sucking it up and not being to account. I'm hopeful though that we're the first guard, and then they're going to get to the next level after they say we tapped all the residents, now it's your turn. So anyway, yes. East Austin Creek is one of the tributaries that has the most potential for restoring native fish populations, and I'm talking here about Chinook and Coho and Steelhead. They are keystone species, which means that they exert a more powerful effect in their environment compared to other species than their actual mass would predict. When these salmon and steelhead die after reproducing, their bodies contribute concentrated nutrients back to the environment, far in excess of their actual weight. The salmon and steelhead trout here spend part of their lives in freshwater, from the time they are eggs until they reach young adulthood, and part in salt water as adults. When the salmon are mature enough to reproduce or spawn, they gather along the coast in the rainy winter months. At this time, large schools of their prey fish also congregate along the coast, providing food needed for further growth and development. When rain causes a salmon's birth creek to fill and run into the river, the salmon literally smells the scent and runs after it, which is what anadromous means. It's the word that's used to describe all fish that migrate back to the birthplace. And in Latin it means running after, so they run back upstream after the scent. There, the female releases eggs in a shallow depression in the gravel of the creek called a red, R-E-D-D, that she creates by swishing her tail back and forth. Males come behind the females and release sperm to fertilize the eggs. The salmon parents die within hours, their bodies serving to nourish other creatures as well as fertilize the forest along the creek. And the other creatures are their own spawn. You know, it kind of reminds me of some of my friends who are putting kids through school. I didn't write that in the book. 2 to 6 months later, the baby salmon called fry emerge in groups, first living off the nourishment in their egg sacs and then from insects and plankton. Up to 3 years later, depending on the type of salmon, they begin a physical transformation that enables them to survive in salt water. This hormonally driven process completely changes their morphology, changes their scales, their kidney function, their liver function, the way they perceive, the way they smell, the way that they can be perceived or hidden from other fish as they migrate to a different environment. Smolts migrate downstream, joining progressively larger waterways, gradually adjusting their appearance and salt tolerance until they're ready for the open ocean. In large groups, they then travel tremendous distances in ocean waters for up to 4 years, likely navigating by magnetic iron in their skulls. That's another thing that blew my mind when I read the literature about fish. At the time of reproductive maturity, they stop eating and start the often arduous migration back toward their individual birthplaces to spawn, just as their parents did. And steelhead are very similar to salmon, except they can go back and forth between fresh and salt water multiple times before they die. So what's happening now in the Russian River tributaries that are considered to be good candidates for restoration is that they're trying to recreate what salmon and steelhead need in order to spawn and live to be, you know, ocean-bound again and then be able to find their way back. And what it requires is very slowly moving water, big woody debris that creates pools in the water where they can get insects and hide out under branches and so forth, and also the lack of erosion. It's really important that there not be silt in the creeks. And unfortunately, upstream from some of the key creeks that feed into the Russian River are privately held lands where people will bulldoze gravel over the creek to form a road. It just takes a minute with the backhoe so they can get from one part of their property to another. And when they grade to create vineyards, all of that gets washed down into those tributaries. So I read an amazing environmental impact report written by a group out of San Francisco for the stewards and for the state parks people administering East Austin Creek backcountry that said that experience has shown that unless you treat each separate tributary, you know, really look all the way to the end of that tributary where it originates, anything you do cosmetically down further in the watershed will be a waste. It'll be a complete waste of time, effort, and money. Because if there's still silt being released upstream, it'll just undo any possibility of a life cycle for the salmon. So now what we're seeing is federal, you know, mandate that we restore salmon, and that's leading to all these changes in our Sonoma County, actually State Water Agency and Sonoma County Water Agency, so that now State Parks is busily engaged in trying to get all of those private landowners to cooperate in a joint effort between the parks and private landowners to restore habitat. I don't know where it's going to go. We all know how we feel about our private property and wine. It's a very, you know, powerful force against restoration. So that's, you know, that's about as much as I... Thank you very much for asking me to read. Yeah. It's something that we're all engaged with, whether we're actively engaged or not. It's going to affect us and all of our families and all of our families' kids and on into the future. And it's a lifetime effort, and it's going to go on for many generations. It's going to be more and more difficult to maintain what we have over time because of overpopulation and burgeoning urban environment very close by. So it's really great to be educated, and it's really great that you are here, and thank you so much again for hosting me.
Well, thank you so much for being here for us. Thank you.